So menopause is actually a pretty strange phenomenon in the animal kingdom.
I'll have what she's having.
This is episode 11 of the Our Better Half podcast, March 20th, 2016, with me, Laura Collins Listermensch, a middle-aged woman with no business talking about sex over 50, except that I am myself over 50 and I'm holding the microphone. This episode's guests are Lauren Ostrowski Fenton, an ASM artist, which we'll explain in a minute. Also, Dr. Rosalind Baculum, who will somehow connect albatrosses with human menopause. And Alberta Knish joins us for part one of her toy series, this one on dildos. Plus, an In Case You Missed It news segment. In a week where the Swedish health minister responded to a noisy sex complaint by a neighbor by endorsing loud lovemaking, we are going to take on a very quiet issue. Imagine this scenario. You have a little secret. No one knows this, but when you're alone, you get on the internet and you search for a certain type of video. These videos, while popular among a certain community, are not something talked about around the elevator at work. A lot of people don't know or pretend they don't know that these videos exist, but you cannot resist. Because when you sit quietly in a room and watch these, you start to feel this amazing physical sensation. It's electrical almost. There on the screen are people, mostly women, talking directly to you as they perform certain acts and role plays. What you see and hear causes this rising involuntary nerve sensation that builds and builds, and then there's a crescendo and you feel relaxed, sleepy even, and you're filled with well-being and peace. And it's sweet, right? Well, I guess it depends on what part of the body you think that we are talking about. What if the sensual buildup and relief were entirely above the belt? In fact, above the collar. What if it was your scalp and neck that experienced all that electricity, and the people in these videos were not only fully dressed, but not doing anything in the least sexually titillating? They're just brushing their hair or opening candy wrappers or cutting tomatoes. Well, what we're exploring today is just that, the phenomena of ASMR, or autonomous sensory meridian response. You can, if you like, say that this is not sex and therefore is not on topic for this podcast, but stick with me a bit. I first heard of ASMR several years back on the This American Life podcast. It was the story of one woman with a strange and somewhat guilty attraction to the Bob Ross painting show. Do you remember that one?
Two hairs and some air. Just gently, gently, gently blend the entire sky.
His soft voice and the brush strokes on the canvas sent her into reveries that others didn't seem to experience. Then, because internet, communities grew up around this strange scalp tingling thing, and word spread about videos and audio recordings of people whispering and rustling silk, acting out scenes where nurses take your pulse, and people were coming out about the sensations that this gave them. I was fascinated then. I still wonder now. I don't have this sensation myself. Are these experiences minor seizures triggered by sound? Are they, as a friend who experiences painless migraines suggested, the triggering of migraines, which are also often followed by sleep? This is the kind of topic that you file away, because if you mention it to your friends and family, they do that smile and wave thing and they get on with their day. And I'm not someone who experiences this, so imagine how it is to try to talk about it if you do. Then, recently, being someone with a podcast about sex, I read that ASMR was trending as a search term on Pornhub, which is the queen of all pornography aggregators. Now, trending doesn't necessarily mean a lot of people search for it as much as it means that more are now looking, but of course, I was intrigued. A place that people use to be stimulated and experience release is not news for sex. But what about this? As it turns out, ASMR and something called ASMR erotica are hugely popular on YouTube and elsewhere. I reached out to a prominent whisperer, her name is Lauren Ostrowski-Fenton, to hear what she thought about the connection and to tell you about ASMR. I need to make it clear, I went to her with the topic in mind, this connection to pornography. She was not promoting it and didn't actually expect the question. As you'll see, she has strong feelings on the topic. I am talking with Lauren Ostrowski-Fenton, also known as the Whispering Mother.
Hello, Lauren. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, I'm really happy to speak with you. I have a quick question. What did you dream of doing when you grew up?
I actually dreamt about being a writer. I watched the movie called My Brilliant Career, and all my life I've dreamt of being a writer.
Well, and you are.
I am about to be, yes, and it's extremely exciting. It's a life dream that many of us have, and so many of us, it doesn't come to fruition. But for me, at my age, my brilliant age.
And what is that age?
Well, I turned 52 this year. It's very exciting.
Yes, that's wonderful.
Thank you, Laura. It's a very special time of our lives.
I'm enjoying it. I definitely think it's our better half. Do you?
I could not say enough how much it's our better half. It's, I think for me, the catalyst is I feel like I've woken up. I feel like I'm alive and awake. Mm.
That's beautiful. Now, I asked to speak with you because I'm very interested in the phenomena of ASMR, for which I think a lot of people would not know that there are over 3 million YouTube videos that mention ASMR. That's enormous. How many YouTube videos have you done?
Well, I've done 499. They're not all ASMR because as I grew as a person, evolved in the last, I think, seven years, I've probably done ASMR videos for the last, I think, 2.5, 3 perhaps. So it's comparatively new for me, but it's new for everybody. It's new for everybody. Yeah, so about 2.5 years I've been doing ASMR.
And you also do podcasts.
I do podcast. I started this journey through health and well-being. So I've taught meditation for many years. I've been a personal trainer. And as I grew older or I accumulated age, I realized that I wasn't content with being a personal trainer. It wasn't enough for me. And when I was 46, my marriage ended. So from not being happy just being a personal trainer to having a relationship end, I wanted something different. I won't say more because I don't think it's about more, but I wanted something different. I wanted to be aware of who I am. Mm. So ASMR was a natural evolution from personal training.
Yeah, you just mentioned that this is a new interest. The community and the recognition of ASMR, I understand, really only happened around 2007. When did you personally first hear about it?
I think I heard about it would be 2011. I started presenting more meditation YouTube videos, and then people from the community reached out to me. So I had Jennifer of Appreciate ASMR and Ilsa from Water Whispers reach out to me and suggest that I do ASMR. Now, when I first looked at it, I had an immediate response to it. I felt immediately comforted by watching it, but I was also aware that it was quite unusual. And in the stage that I was at, I wasn't quite ready for unusual, but with time, I just embraced it, and it's added a whole spectrum to not only my life but my children's life. It's been absolutely amazing in the evolution of who I am and who I believe I am as well, which is just, it's just awesome, Laura.
Do you experience ASMR?
I really experience ASMR. I've had a very interesting childhood because as a child I was significantly bullied and I had some learning difficulties, which I haven't really talked about in the media a lot, but I learned differently to other people. So I was really rejected in social circles and grew up struggling with that because I felt I was sensually really affected by things like sound. Like in the classroom, I could hear all the different sounds and I noticed all the different smells and the aromas. And so I was really stimulated by sound, sight, texture. And I just felt I was really different, and I didn't like, Laura, being different. But as an adult, I embrace it. Mm-hmm. I'm excited by it. I enjoy it. And ASMR is the ability to tune into your senses so you feel comforted, so you feel good, so you can fall asleep, so you can engage with other people. That's kind of the simple explanation for it. But it satisfies your needs for comfort across a number of different areas.
Can anyone experience ASMR?
I don't know. I experience it really strongly, but I guess I believe they can, because I think it's attached to empathy, our sensation of empathy. So if we can feel empathy, if we can have that virtual experience of getting into another person's shoes, yes, I feel that we can feel that.
I'm going to read a quote of someone describing how it feels. Akin to a mild electrical current or the carbonated bubbles in a glass of champagne. I feel envious when I hear that. Is that what you experience?
Absolutely, exactly. Now, speaking to you right now, because you're listening to me and you're interested in what I'm saying, I'm experiencing ASMR right now. So it's tingles up the back of my neck, across my head, like a very, very mild sense of being electrocuted. That sounds terrible, but it's quite a distinct, very non-sexual, very pleasant, very comforting, and it can extend out to the limbs as well. And for me, the more I practice it, the stronger the sensation is.
So it's a skill that you build.
For me it is, yes. That's my personal experience. I definitely build it. And with that building, my ability to meditate or be in the moment or engage with others also increases.
You mentioned that it had something to do with having this personal attention. Can you talk about that?
Okay. When somebody looks into our eyes, and you can almost imagine it, when they look deeply into our eyes, your eyes, my eyes, and they're listening and they care and they tilt their head slightly forward and they're listening to whatever our issue is. Perhaps we're sad, perhaps we're hurt, perhaps we want to talk about an exciting experience, perhaps we want to talk about a piece of writing or art that we've created, and someone leans forward and they're legitimately interested, then I experience, and a lot of other people experience, ASMR. So that's personal attention. Personal attention, ASMR videos are often role-playing, so it could be the illusion or the virtual experience of a dentist inspecting your teeth, or a doctor going through the questioning, or a life coach going through the questioning, or a personal trainer, and they're looking at you in the eyes, they're leaning forward, and they care. They really care about your needs. Now, when you have that situation and you can create the illusion, so you're watching an ASMR video and you believe that that person cares, so it's that virtual experience of caring, then, and I can do it now, like I'm imagining now that situation, I feel it along the back of my scalp, that someone legitimately cares. In my experience, I feel it.
Could you be talking about laundry detergent? Would it matter what the content of what you're saying is?
The content, I believe, and it still hasn't been researched, Laura, I believe it needs to go back to a childhood trigger. So with my viewers, and I get hundreds and hundreds of letters from viewers about their triggers. So something like in my, when I was early at high school, one of the English teachers leaned over my shoulders and he was really excited about an essay I wrote. He read it and he enjoyed it and he really paid attention to various aspects of the letter. I felt that was one of my early triggers. Another trigger was when my mum was teaching me Polish or German and was holding up the cards and touching the cards with her finger and the cardboard cards. She'd hand-drawn the cards. That's another trigger. So they relate to triggers that have importance for that particular viewer. I had one viewer that wasn't accepted in his school and was rejected. No one spoke to him. And two students spent a lot of time with him. Now, those two girls had bags that had zippers on them. So as an adult, the sound of a zipper reminded him of his early childhood experience of being accepted into a little peer group. So I believe it relates to an experience in childhood. Now, if you don't get that trigger, for example, mine is my mother teaching me Polish. For someone else, they may say, well, that's strange because it's not their trigger. So another one is opening Christmas presents as a child. Now when I hear paper being unwrapped, that's a trigger for me, but it may not be for somebody else. So when you say laundry detergent, if that person had a loving mother and they have warm, comforting experiences of watching their mother fill the washing machine, then that could be a trigger. It needs to relate to love and care in early childhood, or that's my personal belief, Laura.
Do you think there's something special about your particular voice that connects with people?
Well, I do. I imagine when I do videos, I imagine one of my letters from a viewer, and I really feel care, concern, sympathy and empathy for the viewer. So before I do the video, I imagine how that person felt. And I believe that comes through the video because I didn't have a great experience as a child. It was pretty terrible. I imagine what my viewer feels like when they're rejected or hurt or marginalized. And I really feel that in the video. So I hope that comes through my voice.
Is it okay if we talk about a controversial issue here?
Oh, go for it. Love it.
Well, I know that there's a division in the community, the ASMR community, about what some people call ASM erotica, a sexual arousal element to ASMR. What's your personal feeling about that?
Is that ASMR is about comfort. Now, comfort is a subjective term and varies depending on the person who's viewing. So some people view my videos and find them sensual. Some find them comforting, some fall asleep, some find them boring, some find them silly. So the fact that there may be, I haven't seen these videos, the fact that they are growing means that that is a need in society or may be a need. But we have to go back to who we are as human beings and what our definition of comfort is. I find a hug from my favourite person comforting. I find a bedtime story perhaps comforting, or a bedtime chat. So what is the definition of comforting for who is the person that needs comforting? Now, my concern there is that ASMR has a huge benefit for people who are experiencing relationship loss or children that are struggling to go to sleep. And I would like the brand image of ASMR to be wholesome so that people don't feel embarrassed. Like, I've got so many young kids that look for videos, but I've also got people in their 40s, 50s and 60s that are lonely, and I would like them to feel assertive and okay about looking for this sort of material.
It's my perception, and I'm not an expert, but it seems that the majority of those posting ASMR content are young females, attractive young females. You're an attractive lady.
Thank you, Laura.
Do you think that appearance, that's where part of this is coming from, this idea that this is to be sexually arousing?
This is such an interesting topic, Laura, because it gets back to something deeper in our psyche as human beings. Now, we're herd animals. We're social by nature, and we thrive with engagement. So we thrive in society. And unfortunately, part of social acceptance and belonging, which I don't like, but we have to look at facts and then we can move away from those facts. Part of social engagement and part of the rules of social acceptance is that we're attractive. Because, you know, it's the peacock phenomenon, that the peacock sticks its tail out and that is attractive. Now, as women, I have to say, as an older woman, I would like to move away from that, but I still put on my foundation. I still brush my hair. I still look at the mirror and assess whether I'm attractive to the rest of society. I've now started to get comments, only a couple, but comments about my age, because I must be the oldest high-profile ASM artist in the world. And I get comments about anything from why are you doing it when you're so old, to people calling me an old hag, to people saying I'm attractive or attempt to be attractive. But at the same time, I think we have to address that people are going to do what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And we have to be okay anyway. So if we go around saying we don't want any erotica, there's going to be erotica. There's going to be porn. There's always going to be that aspect of society. But how do we, I think if we jump up and down and say, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, it's like making alcohol illegal in the 1920s. I think we have to address this with compassion, and we have to address this without a strong response of negativity, and just be who we are.
So do you feel that ASMR is distinct from erotic titillation or stimulation?
I think ASMR is an experience which is interpreted by the viewer. Now, there's all sorts of people in the world. There's people that are balanced and there's people that are not so balanced. There's people with good hearts, people that don't always have such good hearts. There's people with different agendas. So, yes, I think that it's distinct, but that's my interpretation.
I think that's an important point for you to be able to make. I really appreciate you making that.
I wasn't ready for the question. I'm often conservative in my response, but yeah, I would be very, very unhappy. And if I was fully aware, which I may look at that, I would post a video about my feelings. But the concern about that is you almost add to the controversy.
There is that. Well, I thought it was interesting because here my topic is sex, and I have been fascinated by ASMR since I heard a podcast about it a couple of years ago. And when I saw there was a connection, I thought, oh, I need to talk to someone who's doing this who's over 50. And that's how I sought you out.
Well, there's also the connection when we're talking about sex. Sex is really for women about intimacy, physical intimacy. And one of the things that ASMR can do is can give you the illusion when you're lonely. Like I've got one video where I have dinner with someone on a Saturday night, because I get a lot of viewers who are aging, they're lonely, they've had their partner of 20 years have an affair or whatever. So they can get that intimacy and that feeling of comfort from watching a video. Now, the line between that feeling of comfort and some sexual comfort is a fine line, but there is moral benefits in that as well. When we want someone to hug us, it's about comfort. And ASMR can really give, on one of the videos, I hug someone. So I pretend to hug the video because that person's experiencing loss. Mm-hmm. Now that's not sexual, mm-hmm. but our physical comfort is moving towards that line. Why do we go into relationships? Why do we want physical intimacy? Because it makes us feel good. It makes us feel accepted. And when we're getting older, we need it just as much.
Mm-hmm.
I think a really valid reason for ASMR is, you know, I always say in a lot of the videos, imagine I'm holding your hand. I'm going to give you a hug. As a female, and I'm a single woman, I don't have a partner. A hug to me is a big deal. It's very, very comforting. I'm extremely resilient, but we all like a good hug. And ASMR can give us that sensation. But it's a valid sensation. It's legitimate and it's okay.
ASMR recognition is new, but what do you see for the future?
Well, I would like ASMR to be used in orphanages, in childcare centres, as part of it to assist psychologists to help people sleep. But it needs its brand image to be legitimised. So I think that the stronger ASMRists, such as myself and the well-known ASMRists, need to stand and say, these are the benefits. This is what it does. It's really wonderful, but it's in its infant stages.
Thank you. I'm grateful for this opportunity to chat about this. Shall we whisper our farewells? I want to try it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Laura. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
This has been really great, Lauren. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Laura.
Listen, after meeting Lauren, I too felt protective of the ASMR community. After all, how tender and sweet it is for people to feel connected, and how neat that some people get this genuine charge and afterglow from crinkling and brushing and whispering. I've read a great deal now about ASMR people, even those who are doing what is called ASMR erotica, feeling that they're doing something beautiful and caring, not vulgar or obscene. Even the top ASMR erotica folks tend to say that they're meeting a need that porn isn't filling, a sense of connection and feeling cared for. And then here's what I realized. The question isn't whether ASMR is porn, even if it's being hosted on porn sites. It's how many of us think of porn that maybe we need to reconsider. There's an assumption that turning people on or seeking to be turned on is inherently not just private, but vulgar. And that, as an old prude from way back, is something for me to consider. If seeking and finding stimulation and connection with virtual strangers above the neck isn't wicked, then perhaps we need to soften up, as it were, about below the collarbone connections. As Lauren says, seeking connection is normal and positive, and ASMR contact comes in two categories, intentional and unintentional. What tickles one person's scalp may tickle another person elsewhere, just as intentionally pornographic material may be a turn off to others. Different strokes for different folks is not an exaggeration. Some of the intentionally stimulating stuff out there is exploitive, and much is in poor taste. But there's always going to be that element of what people are looking for and provide. ASMR causes me to look at erotica and porn from a new angle. And letting go of judgment is not a bad thing, even for prudes. I am talking with Dr. Roslyn Baculum, our podcast's sexy science correspondent. She has something to report.
Thanks for having me again, Laura. This week, I want to talk to you about an albatross that just had another baby chick. The albatross's name is Wisdom, which should give you a hint as to why she's so special. She lives in the Midway Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and last month, at the age of 65, she actually had another healthy little chick. And she is the oldest known albatross, the oldest known wild bird to actually have a chick. And scientists all over were really impressed because, you know, even though wild birds can be incredibly long-lived, it's pretty unusual for humans to think of someone else who's well into an age we think of as quote-unquote menopausal actually be having babies.
How long do albatrosses,
yeah. How long do they live? Scientists really don't know. It's hard to track them. You have to band them on their legs. It's harmless. They're really lightweight. They don't hurt the birds in any way. And, you know, scientists will follow them year after year. But since they live for so long, it's hard to follow them until the end of their lives. And also, once these albatrosses in particular get beyond adolescence, they all look the same. There aren't any signs of aging. It's not like they have gray hair and you can guess that they're somewhat older. Wisdom, the albatross, looks the same at 65 as lots of other albatrosses do at age 3. So it's really hard to get an estimate. You have to be able to track the bird, tag it when it's just been born, and then follow it. So researchers really aren't even sure that Wisdom is, in fact, 65. That's the lower limit. She could be much older, but scientists don't really know.
And she laid an egg, and she raised a chick.
Yes. Well, she's currently raising the chick. And scientists actually think that she's more likely to be successful at raising her chick to maturity than a younger mother because she's had so much experience with this that really gives her an advantage. Young mothers often make mistakes. That's pretty normal. Sometimes the mistakes are fairly harmless. Other times, you know, in the wild, it can result in the chicks dying. And so, you know, Wisdom's probably gone through all those mistakes already and knows what to do and what not to do.
Wow. What does this say about fertility?
What's really interesting is that, you know, as much as we think, you know, in human societies that growing older is a time to stop having children, in the animal world, that's usually not the case. Humans are one of the only species that actually has a menopause, what researchers call in more technical terms, prolonged post-reproductive lifespan. It's been noted in blue whales and one other whale species, but that's about it. And in humans, given that it takes so long to raise a child to full maturity, to be able for them to fend for themselves, it would make sense that you wouldn't want to be reproducing right up until your old age, because you need to be able to help your child for quite some time. But in other species where, you know, the parental investment is less, or at least it's not for such a long period of time, many species go on reproducing right up until they die. So menopause is actually a pretty strange phenomenon in the animal kingdom.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, there's one hypothesis from an anthropologist at the University of Utah, I believe, who has developed, she calls it the grandmother hypothesis, and that the extra child care afforded by grandmothers who are done reproducing themselves and can invest all of their time and energy into supporting their own offspring's children actually provided a huge advantage in early human societies and helped fuel the evolution of menopause.
That's great. The grandmother hypothesis?
Yes, indeed.
I like it. I like it a lot. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome.
While we're in a quiet mood for our weekly Kegel exercise break, our favorite new whisperer will talk us through.
As we do our Kegel exercises, we're going to breathe in through the nose and out through the nose. Let's try three rounds and connect it with our breath. Inhale in through the nose. And exhale out through the nose. And again. And once more, breathe in.
Alberta Knish, nice to talk with you.
Hi, Laura. It's great to talk with you again.
Alberta Knish is our senior correspondent of old sex. What do you have for us today?
Well, this is the first part of a two-parter, Laura. I got interested in the history of sex toys, and it turns out human beings have been really, really prolific in creating sex toys. So first, we're going to just talk about your straight-up history of the dildo and then get into parts with moving parts.
Okay.
In Germany, in a dig that was done, the very famous Hohlefeld Caves, where a lot of our paleo ancestors have artifacts have been found, a phallus that is believed to be about 28,000 years old was found. It's very smooth. It's the markings on it can't really be interpreted as anything other than penile. And, you know, now the debate is that, you know, what was it for? Was it religious? Was it actually, was it used in a ritual somehow? What, you know, was it used for pleasure is something that you don't see discussed in the academic papers. But, you know, looking at the thing, you have to wonder, did it just sit there going unused night and day?
Or maybe it was just a really, really, really early dick pic.
Yes, was there a model? There are so many questions lost in the antiquities. So dildos have actually been found pretty much everywhere in the world that we have found artistic level artifacts. I'm not talking Parthenope shards from or arrowheads from 60,000 years ago. There are Chinese dildos that go back about 12,000 years. They have been found in Africa, in the Middle East, in Europe. The materials that people came up with. There are bronze ones. There are jade ones. There are plaster and stone. It's really incredible. And one of the things that's interesting is how lifelike they are. I mean, sometimes they're just sort of oblong with just the very barest resemblance to an actual penis. And sometimes, like there is a bronze one from about 1,000 years ago that appears to have been molded from the owner's actual penis.
Hmm. Why do we think so?
Just because it has very normal irregularities and a curvature.
Ah.
Yeah, you know, like not all penises fly straight and narrow. Some point a little to the left, some point to the right or up or down. So in that respect, an idealized one that might look sort of like, oh, you know, just not in proportion to what would actually be found on a body or just very perfect representation. This isn't that. It's one that people are looking at and think it shows the vein that runs along the underside of most men's penises. It's a very, very detailed piece of work. Mm-hmm. And then we enter sort of the more recent era. I mean, if you read literature, the accounting of men, when travel time used to be so long, there are many, many accounts in many cultures of men leaving their wives with dildos or men leaving mistresses with dildos. And they could have been made of glass, was a very common material. Wood, as we talked about in the Hia homes, plaster was used. And in the modern era, we've relied to sort of kinder, softer technology. So there's silicon and rubber and things that might feel a little bit more realistic, if you will. From the early ones, which scholars want to believe are religious, modern ones are clearly made for use in sexual encounters. There are a lot of different kinds of uses. I mean, it was not uncommon for people to believe that regular orgasms were healthy. And this is something that, you know, we might associate in the modern era with Dr. Ruth, but this is an idea that the ancient Greeks actually had.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, they often believed that the lack of orgasms was the reason that women's health problems happened in the first place. And they would call it wandering womb syndrome and felt that, you know, if your wife were being difficult at home, then this might be the issue. And if you didn't really want to deal with that, you know, give her a dildo and have her fix that problem herself.
Was that also true for men?
Now, there's never a presumption that men aren't able to be as sexually active as they want to, that I can find, at least not in the ancient Greek medical writings.
But there's also been many prohibitions against masturbation. So were women considered different in this way?
Now, see, this is one of the interesting things. If if the doctor ordered it, you're not doing it because you're having licentious thoughts or, you know, because you're a loose woman of low moral character. Mm-hmm. If you're having physical symptoms and your doctor prescribes it, then this is clearly something that lets you off the moral hook, if you will. Mm-hmm. However, in the 16 and 1700s in Europe, at least, there was a lot of belief that for men, masturbation would cause impotence and sexually transmitted disease. The presumption is if you need to do something with your penis, you should do it with a vagina. Uh-huh. Rather than your hand. When it comes to actual manual masturbation, you know, this is something we find in cave paintings. This is something that is written about in almost all medical texts that we have, which go back maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years. There are depictions of it or discussions of it in ancient Greece, in ancient Egypt. What's interesting about both of those cultures is that it was considered acceptable for men and women, which, as we know, over time, one or the other one has been more or less sanctioned, if you will, or allowed, acknowledged that that was a personal need, whereas it's rare to find the same amount of sexual freedom being allotted to men and to women.
Very interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to part two.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In case you missed it, some news from the world of sex. In Sweden, a gentleman was annoyed that his neighbors were not following community guidelines for noise after 10, when vacuums and drilling are not allowed. This fellow's neighbors were having loud sex often, and he appealed to the health minister to intercede. The minister considered the request but responded that, quote, it seems nice for them, and refused to sanction the lovers, saying that loud sex was healthy. There's a chain of skirt clubs setting up in more and more cities around the world. These women-only sex clubs feature champagne all night and promise a contrast to the male pleasure-oriented sex clubs that the founders grew tired of for the focus on body parts and not atmosphere. Watch out, boys. At these clubs, it's about empowerment, the founder says. Quote, we have a saying that confidence in the bedroom leads to confidence in the boardroom, and, I read, that all the patrons clean up after themselves before they leave. The Huffington Post, where, by the way, I have a column, changed its gay voices section to queer voices in a decision that drew both cheers and surprise. Queer, like many words once used as slurs, is increasingly used to be both inclusive and relevant. The term queer includes lesbian, gay, bisexual, pansexual, as well as those genders that challenge society's assumptions like transsexual, intersex, and genderqueer. This name reflects a changing society, but also points up conversations happening to more and less comfort everywhere. Older people are frequently victimized by scammers on the phone and now, of course, on the internet. So it's natural that online dating is targeting folks, but with a twist, robots. Many of the accounts and messages on online dating sites and apps aren't real people. If you're looking for love and need it to be human, be alert. Many online profiles, especially of women, are fakes backed by scam artists looking for victims. Hold on to your heart and your credit card. Looking for a second income? Apparently, 6% of Americans have been paid for sex, and 7% have paid for it. And these numbers were nearly the same for those above and below 65 years old, so don't anyone get on their high horse. 1% of those over 65, quote, don't know if they've ever paid anyone for sex. It's not something I think I'd forget, but I lost my keys again yesterday. So, you have to love the physicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Big brain, super adorable, bringing science to the masses. But NDT got into trouble with biologists this week for tweeting about sex and not in a good way. He said that sex that was painful wouldn't remain in the gene pool, but biologists around the world, in some pain themselves over the gaffe, started naming all the reasons this was wrong. I'm sure that some BDSM lovers chimed in as well. Not everything that sends your DNA into the future is fun. Ask cats. Cat sex sounds like it hurts, and it does. And being eaten by your praying mantis mate. And let's not even talk about ducks. I'm sure it's worth it, but it's not necessarily pain-free. Thank you for listening in. I'll be on the road this next week, so catch the podcast again in 2 weeks. Please visit ourbetterhalf.net for information on the topics and guests, and tell your friends about the podcast. Keep sending ideas and guest requests. I love them. And old people, don't let your day get away from you. Get in a really pleasant orgasm today. You won't regret it. And we won't tell your friends why you're smiling so much lately.
It's raining outside. There's thunder. I can see trees waving, almost saying hello.